Okay. You know, he acts on his passions. Where there are competing passions within his soul, then he will tend to act on the more powerful one. Now that's one. So there are a number of principles operative here. One, where there are competing passions, he will act on the more powerful one. What tends to make a passion more powerful than another one? The immediacy of the achievement of the goal. If a passion can be satisfied right away, it will tend to be more powerful than a passion which can be satisfied next week. And so if you have a choice between something you can have right now, something you can have a week from now, you will, you know, everything else being equal, you will tend to act on what you can have right now rather than what you can have next week. And so this is a second kind of principle. And, you know, there are a few other kinds of principles also. The passion which is more vivid, or the object of the passion which is more vivid, will tend to have a stronger effect than the one which is less vivid. David Hume distinguished sense impressions and impressions of the mind, you know, ideas which we have, strictly in terms of their vividness. And he said sense impressions are more vivid than mental impressions. If you have a choice between kissing, you know, a sort of good-looking girl which is right in front of you, or a magnificently beautiful girl whom you may meet next week, what are you going to do? So that's the way the human creator operates. Now, this is simply set forth by the Federalist writers. It's not argued, it's not debated, they simply present it as fact. I find that very remarkable, because this is not a commonly shared view of man. And certainly it's not a view of man that Jefferson would have agreed with. But they simply set it forward as fact. They don't even argue for it. They state it. They don't debate it. Consequently, no human being can be trusted with power. Obviously, this rules out monarchy, dictatorship, those forms of government. You cannot trust a single human being to run a show. So you cannot set up a government that is dependent on the whims and caprices of a single person. So that means you're going to have to rule out that kind of a government. That leaves you then with group government, government of the whole, or a mix. Men are selfish, passionate, full of whims, capricious, prejudice. They are never fully rational, calm, or dispassionate. Man has always been this way, as far back as we know, and for all we know, he will always be this way. He's not likely to be changed by education or anything else like that. He tends to be more responsive to momentary passions and immediate interests than to general or remote considerations of policy, utility, or justice. Addison, Federal Paper 37. The history of almost all of the great councils and consultations held among mankind for reconciling their discordant opinions, I'm quoting now, assuaging their mutual jealousies and adjusting their respective interests is a history of factions, contentions, and disappointments, and may be classed among the most dark and degraded pictures which display the infirmities and depravities of the human character. Wish Paul Hain were here right now, because Paul proposed Monday that we should go back to the Greek city-state, and that's Madison's description of the history of the Greek city-state. Yeah, dark and degraded picture of human passions competing with one another for self-satisfaction. The kind of an exception on the Constitutional Convention at Philadelphia, Madison says, it must have enjoyed to a very singular degree an exemption from the pestilential influence of party animosities, the disease incident to deliberative bodies, and most apt to contaminate their proceedings. All classes, rich and poor, are afflicted with that same infirmity. Consequently, that rules out aristocratic rule. The fact that a guy's a rich man or that he went to Harvard or Princeton doesn't mean that he isn't going to have the same kind of problems as the guy who's a dirt farmer and never went to school anywhere. So consequently, you can't say, well, we'll put in aristocratic government and we'll let the better people rule. They've got the same problems. They will also have the tendency to run it for their interests. So you see, we're narrowing the field down, and pretty soon we're going to be left with the alternatives of democracy or republican form of government. All men act on impulse rather than on reason and on very narrow conceptions of their own self-interest. All right, since man is this kind of a critter, how can we create a government which will be structured so that it lasts? So that it will be durable. Now they use the word durable over and over again. You know, and it gives you this idea of, you know, like buying clothes for your kids, for your little kids, you know, and that they'll be durable and they'll last the rough and tumble of play. See, and they're thinking about a government that can take stress and tension and pressure and its citizens pushing it as far as they can, straining it to the limits. How can we produce a government that will hold up under the strains and pressures that human beings put it to? And at the same time, we'll give human beings a maximum freedom of behavior. Now, there are a number of kinds of governments that you can put together that will be durable. You see, all you have to do is to beat your citizenry into insensibility, you know, or give them tranquilizers every day, all kinds of things you can do to keep your citizenry passive. But that doesn't give them freedom. And so the hooker in the situation is, how can you produce a government that will both give people maximum freedom and at the same time the government survives the onslaughts that in their freedom they make on their government? Okay, the answer is a government which can control factions. And faction is the dirty word that we're going to be working with. And Federalist 10's subject is faction and how to control faction. Madison defines faction as a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by a common impulse of passion. In other words, two or more people that are sharing a common passion for a particular goal or interest, adverse to the rights of other citizens. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong, but it means that if they satisfy what they want, what other citizens want is not going to get satisfied. And so they constitute a faction. They constitute a pressure group. Today we might say, well, they constitute a lobby. So it may be adverse to what some other citizens want, who also may constitute a faction, or to the permanent or aggregate interests of the entire community, in which case it would be pernicious. But the picture that they are presenting us of American political society, or for that matter, any political society, is that any political society is made up of a lot of little interest groups that are pressuring for what they want. And these interest groups are not permanent interest groups. You know, they're changing and shifting and their population moves in and out and so on. But there's a kind of a wiggling and struggling, you know. It's about like 10 kittens in a gunny sack. You know, and they're wiggling and crawling and struggling all over trying to grab what they can get. All right, how are we going to control factions? Because what one wants to avoid is that a faction achieves power over the rest of the populace. Because if they achieve power over the rest of the populace, they oppress the rest of the populace. So you have to prevent a particular faction from getting control and imposing its will on the rest. Those of us in the Missouri Senate have heard of that happening. So what are you going to do? There are two kinds of things you can do with a faction. And I always like number 10 because it's beautiful platonic dialectic. And the whole argument moves dialectic. And I'll try and set the argument out and then we'll go back and talk about it and also criticize it. two ways of controlling a passion. One, control passion. One is control, or is destroy, cause passion. The other one is to control the passion. Right? To open. How can you destroy the cause? Either by destroying the cause of the cause, which is destroy liberty, or you cause all to have one opinion. Okay, take a look at that. If we destroy liberty, we destroy our reason for government. So we can't take that kind of alternative. There's no purpose in having government, which is to ensure liberty to people, if in order to have it, you've got to destroy their liberty. So that's not a viable alternative. The other alternative, destroy, cause them all to have one opinion. Very few of the government is going to have to coerce them, even if, you know, if you could do it. You cause them all to have one opinion. If you cause them all to have one opinion, then they don't have freedom of opinion. And so, whichever kind of direction that you go here, you are going to destroy the reason for having government to start with. Now, this is going to be the direction that Mao Zedong will go. All right, we're going to control the effects. What? So we have faction, and a given faction is influential. That faction will either be a minority or it will be a majority. So if it's a minority, what do? We have a majority, vote them out, right? No sweat. We know nowadays that the minority can be much more powerful than that. If it's a majority, you can't vote it out. But there are two things you have to, one or two things that you will have to do. Either this majority will destroy the government, and that you don't want, or it will not destroy the government, but the majority is prevented from feeling a common passion, or, if it feels a common passion, it is prevented from acting on it. Now, how can we put a government together? And this we can't do anything about. How can we put a government together which, by virtue of its structure, we can guarantee that we will either always have minority factions, or if we have a majority faction, it will be prevented from feeling a common passion, or it will be prevented from acting. How can we put together that kind of government? Well, the authors of the Federalist Papers here have proposed that that's what we have in the United States Constitution. Our two alternatives that we're down to now are a pure democracy and a republic. The form of government that's been proposed, a representative government. Okay, what are the factors that are involved here? The basic difference between a republican form of government and a democratic form of government are two. One, in a republican form of government, decisions are made by representatives of the people, not by the people themselves. In a democratic form of government, the people themselves make the decision. The whole gang gets together and votes on what they're going to do, and the majority decides. Republican form of government, the representatives get together, debate, and vote, and so on. Secondly, they differ in size. It's theoretically in size. A democracy is limited in how big it can be. It has to be very, very small because the people have to be able to get together as often as the need arises and vote, you know, debate the issues and vote on them. In a republican form of government, you can have it extremely large. because every voter represents a large number of people. And, you know, there's really theoretically no limit to how large a number of people can be represented by a given representative. Now, Madison says what we've got to aim here at is a kind of a golden mean, trace of Aristotle here. If there are too few people that he represents, he will have a parochial view. If there are too many people that he represents, he'll be out of touch with his constituency and he won't be able to express their viewpoint or understand it. Now, there's another consideration here also. If you are a representative of too small a group of people, what will tend to happen is they will become a faction. And so you then will not be a representative, but you will be a faction leader. You'll be a lobbyist for a particular faction. And that we want to avoid. So consequently, if you make the constituency bigger, there will be two or more factions that you will be representing, and then you can't represent one of them. And so one of the principles that is operative here is always aim to have at least two factions vying for power in any particular part of the government. And then, you know, each one will work against the other one and keep the other one weak. It's sort of an application of the divide and conquer principle, except that what you're, you know, the enemy is us. Whom we're trying to conquer. The enemy is not somebody else. Okay. The question now is, which one of these is going to come closest to achieving the kind of government that we're going to need in order to control factions, to prevent oppression? They argue that the Republican form of government will do this. Number one. You remember, if you go back to our how the human critter works in action, okay, passionate feeling arises and it leads to action unless there is the interposition of the mind deliberating over it, thinking over it, and obviously if the mind thinks it over before you act, you are more likely to act intelligently than if you don't. All right, what is this in the political body? That's the representative, deliberating. The people want something. The representatives talk it over, debate it, and decide. So, if you're working with a representative form of government, you will always have a filtering effect of the deliberation of rational men before action takes place. If you have people meeting and they vote on what they're going to do, if it's a heated kind of issue where they feel very strongly on, they're likely to act impulsively without thinking and regret it afterwards. So consequently, the Republican deliberative form of government gives us a kind of control that functions in here that will, you know, that will hold us off from, at least in most cases, from foolish actions, which we will live to regret afterwards, or which may bring about the destruction of our society. All right, now that sounds terrific, doesn't it? Except, how do you know that your representatives are going to be these calm, dispassionate, sensible people? And we already said that man is by nature a passionate critter and that there aren't certain people that are exempt from this. Well, some people are more rational than other ones are, and so the problem is, how are we going to get the right kind of representatives that get elected? Which form of government is going to produce them? A small republic or a large republic? Well, here we engage in a little bit of proportional mathematics, which is written a bit obscurely, and it takes a while to figure it out in Madison. But in brief, it operates this way. And he's now talking about having large republics or small republics. Now, he's talking here for a reason. Because when he's talking about small republics, he means the state of Massachusetts, the state of New York, the state of Delaware, as opposed to a national government. And so when he's pitting small republic against large republic, what he's really saying is, which form of government is going to work out better and be more durable? A states' rights confederation or a federal national government? As a political society increases in size, it needs its public employees, let's say its representatives, let's just stick to representatives. The number of representatives it needs will probably increase, let's say something like that. It increases very slowly. So that represents the number of, let's make this neutral. That represents the number of representatives that we need as a particular country gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Right? This represents the increase in the population. Now, what we're looking for is how many good potential politicians do we have in the society? So he says, well, probably, or what is most likely, is that the number of good potential representatives will be proportionate to the population, at least proportionate. And so consequently, it parallels that. And so let's say it goes like this. Now, we take a small republic here and a large republic here. And you compare this ratio to this ratio, what do you find? You find that the larger the republic, the better the ratio is, the better the likelihood is that you're going to get good representatives. The smaller, the less likely you're going to have good representatives. So a big republic is better than a small republic. Convincing? Suppose we use the same kind of logic and we talked about rascals. Crooks who want to get political office so that they can manipulate it and work it for their own benefit. What's their ratio to the population, Mary? Proportionate?
It'd be proportionate.
Well, it will tend to be proportionate, right?
Yeah.
Oh, proportionate. And let's be very nice and assume it's a much smaller number than we could get. It's going to be proportionate. What conclusion do we draw? That a smaller republic is better than a bigger republic because there's a much smaller percentage of a relative percentage of crooks that could get elected to office and people. See, but Madison didn't tell you that. So, the very same argument will prove that the small republic is better than the big republic, and I claim credit for that discovery, and none of the states' rights boys have ever seen that. At least I've never seen any of them argue. So, in brief, a pure democracy, in other words, a government of the whole, which by necessity will have to be small and regional, you know, localized, will be unable to handle the problem of factions. This is why the Greek city-states had such short lives, and why their history was a history of contention and squabbling and fighting over things. All one has to do is think about the typical Lutheran voters assembly, you know, to realize that, because we battle with one another over whether to spend one postage stamp or two and so on. Okay. What about the Republic? Yes, it can handle factions. How? One, if we elect good people to office, they will have that filtering effect on the will of the people to prevent the people from engaging in actions which are not good for them. It is less likely to elect bad guys than the other form of government, and the larger the republic gets, the more the likelihood increases that that there will be good people in government. All right, now there's another advantage, and this is how I can rescue Madison now from his goof here on proportions. Where will you find more factions, in a small country or in a big country? you will find more factions in a big country. All right? The smaller the republic, the fewer the factions. The fewer the factions, the more likely that one of them will become the majority faction and dominate all the others. And so consequently, what you want to aim at is the larger republic. And the more factions, the greater, you know, a larger number of interests. Because the more interests you have in a country, the weaker each one will be, and the less likely any of them will be to become the dominant interest that will suppress all the other interests. And so consequently, the writers of the Federalist Papers come out very clear and strong for what we call a pluralistic society. And the salvation of America will be pluralism, not a unified thought or a unified idea. So in summary then, in a large republic, you have the advantage that you are more likely to get good people elected to office who will take an objective, uninvolved view of the will of the people. Secondly, you are more likely to elect bad ones than good ones. Thirdly, it will be harder for a faction to get majority control of the government, since you will have more factions, and also since there will be more territory that they will have to maintain control over. He finally concludes then by saying, having a mixed government, as we are proposing, a government with states and a national government is really great. Because under these kinds of conditions, it will be possible, although very unlikely, but possible, that a given faction may become so powerful that it controls a complete state. But at least now it's got 12 other states to cope with that can keep it under control. And so we have the ship of state divided into 13 watertight bulkheads, and we can close off one bulkhead and prevent a problem in one state from spreading to another state. And at the same time, we have a national government, so we got a kind of a double security system built in here. And terrific. What better government could you want than that? Mary?
Well, I just told you that the whole precept simply are false. He told you that the curse of the man is that he is guided by his passions, and that the men who are going to elect the representatives are going to be guided by their passions. Therefore, the men who are running for office are going to appeal to the passions, and they're all going to be passionate animals who are not guided by reason.
Yeah.
Which is what we're in right now.
Yeah.
So then that leaves you with the possibility of accomplishing anything if that was a
keeper
and have the wrong thing.
Yeah, and hope that you've got a benevolent one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there, but it ultimately...
I mean, I was wondering how did he, you know, did he allow for this, or say, well, this is the best, this is sort of the midway between two
worlds. Yeah. There's no way that you can put together a perfect government.
No.
And so consequently, what you aim at is the best you can come up with. And what he was saying was that with it set up in this kind of way, the various interests will have a tendency to check one another. And in the total mix, if we got a big enough and varied enough mix, you know, we're likely, for the most part, in the long run, to luck out. You know, and in brief, that's as much as he's arguing for.
You know, in total, though, is he really wrong? I mean, how many people in the United States would you say actually vote intelligently or intellectually as compared to passionately or emotionally when it comes right down to voting time, for whether it be for a representative or a senator? Mm. How many of the voting body who get out there actually know how that person has voted on the various bills, or what he stands for, what his platform is? That's a difficult question to answer, but
yeah.
I would have to say it's got to be in a minority, I would think. Wouldn't you agree?
Mm-hmm. Now bear in mind that we've got one value that we're operating with here, and that's durability. Government survival. And bear in mind, the government's 199 years old, which is pretty old for governments. think there are today, there are only two governments today that are still in existence that are, that in their present form are older than the United States, and one is Iran, with a Shah form of government that's a couple thousand years, about 3,000 years old, is their claim. And I think the other one is Ethiopia, with a hereditary monarchy, and that one just got overthrown. So that one's done, that one's different now. One government left, that in its present form is older, you know, a reasonably present form is older than the United States government. There are only two governments today that are still in existence that in their present form are older than the United States, and one is Iran, with a Shah form of government that's a couple thousand years, about 3,000 years old is their claim. And I think the other one is Ethiopia, with a hereditary monarchy, and that one just got overthrown. So that one's done, that one's different now. One government left, that in its present form is older, you know, a reasonably present form is older than the United States government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of sense a flaw in their thinking, in the sense of trying to balance power between, say, states and the federal government, in that it neglects other sources of power, mm-hmm. which in our country today have, in a sense, taken over. Things like, say, the oil companies, which provide a lot of our basic energy sources, the railroads and so on, provide all our transportation. We're very dependent on these, and yet there is no political check and balance system over these sources of power.
Is this the fault of the system, or is the system capable of dealing with that, only we haven't thought of how to do it, or we're too lazy to, or something?
Well, weren't the federal papers written at a time when the technological base was fairly low, and we're talking about an atomistic model where within a state there'd be a large number of industries supplying people's needs, and very little chance that one person or one industry could gain enough power to have any great effect and form any large factions, even within a state. And whereas now we have industries like the oil industry, which are capable of swaying the federal government.
Yeah, the one, the the one value that, that they're operating with here, that, and I think I indicated before that it was limited, their assumption is that a faction is unable to be dictatorial unless it achieves majority status. And they were mistaken in that, because we know that, that a minority faction can achieve dictatorial status, and as a matter of fact, if a faction wants to achieve dictatorial status, it's better off being a minority, because if it becomes majority, it gets unwieldy. And, you know, keep it small, efficient, one step ahead of the other factions. And that's, you know, that's been the modern history. But to that extent, yeah. But at the same time, I suspect that you could deal with some of those kind of problems by using faction-type language in figuring out faction-type strategies. And, you know, how can we neutralize the effect of that faction? How can we do this? How can we do that? Nader's Raiders is a faction. Common Cause is a faction that are set up as counterfactions, aren't they? And we're still operating on a factional kind of base to deal with the problem of faction. But one of the fascinating things about Madison's idea about government here was that if government stimulated a multiplicity of factions, that all that it had to do would function largely in a regulatory kind of way, or like referee at the boxing match and see to it that nobody killed somebody else or fought unfairly. But then, you know, let the factions struggle back and forth, you know, the open marketplace of ideas and so on, and out of this open struggle, only the best would come. Now, granted, you know, there's a great deal of idealism and optimism here about, in spite of this very pessimistic notion about the nature of man, it's very optimistic about the outcomes of what can be achieved.
The nature of method.
Yeah, right. Method is the critical thing, and it's fascinating that 200 years ago, you got guys who are talking method and strategy. You know, latter 20th century kind of ideas. Now, Marshall McLuhan wasn't the first guy to talk about method. And so it's very modern talk, even though they were living in a, you know, very early industrial age and couldn't begin to think of problems like international conglomerates and, you know, or industries that are economically so important that you know, they dominate the scene. At the same time, there's a famous quote in 10 which Henry Steele Commager grabbed onto and thought that James Madison was the first one to talk about economic determinism. He raised the question of economics. Then he thought that this came in before Karl Marx. Now let's see if I can find it. Find the tail end of it. Well, anyway, he says that what distinguishes human beings from one another is their varying capacity to acquire property. And it is the protection of their property that largely motivates them. And consequently, the function of government is to control their interfering interests so that each one is able to maximize the maximize his liberty and the possession and enjoyment of his property. The accumulation of property produces classes. See where we're starting to go? Accumulation of property begins to produce classes which then are in conflict with one another. Now, so far it sounds like we're going right down Karl Marx's road. You know, and this is Federalist 10. But at this point then he says, and this is where Henry Steele Commager forgot to keep on reading. He says, of course, then we have all kinds of classes. We have cooks, and we have bakers, and we have cobblers, and we have farmers. See, the classes are professions. They're not economic classes. They're professions. And what happens is, is the bakers all have a common interest. You know, they want low prices for flour and low salaries for assistant bakers and low income tax for bakery owners. You know,
and
they all want that. Right, that's right. High prices for bread. And no government control over what you put in it. And the cobblers will want low bread prices. Well, these are what Madison calls classes. But he says, what will happen is we will have interest groups that develop. Now, we've got the oil industry interest group, and we've got group interest groups that are opposed to the oil industry group. What do you have to do to prevent the oil industry from dominating America? I suppose one thing each one of us can do is walk more. Put our temperature down lower. And our, you know, we're the buyers. And so if we start forming a faction of buyers of oil, and we start figuring out how we can dominate the situation instead of the oil industry, you know, we will.
It's a little more complex than just what the individual can do on his own front
though. Oh yeah, but that's why you form a faction.
It's beginning.
Well, sure. See, and the forming of factions is natural. At least it's natural in the United States. I don't know whether it is elsewhere.
Is the faction the same as a pressure group?
Yeah.
Faction?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the
or an interest group.
Well, who has been a faction in terms of getting something done about the tailings?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And but now it's been very, very difficult to get people to write letters to their respective congressmen and senators, and really there have not been so many, but the very fact that there were some shows you the kind of effect that a faction or pressure group will have on the Congress if you just, you know, put some paper in a typewriter and write to the man that you're voting for or not voting for. And I think sometimes we are not aware enough of the power of a pressure group. In terms of very few people, actually, when you look at the aggregate, it doesn't look like many. But it produced it finally. Now we've got, you know, now we're getting contractors up to take this, and they've made bids on the tailings.
See, and that's the way it works, and this is the way Madison was envisioning it working. Now, what are things that a faction can do to prevent other factions from interfering with it, you know, and to neutralize other factions? One is they can suppress information. And they can distribute false information. Or they can, you know, work people up, work on people's passions. They can engage in economic sanctions. See, there are all kinds of techniques you can use, you know, that are dirty pool to prevent other factions from getting their will, or you become the dominant faction. Well, see, every faction knows what you can do to be the winner. And then you figure out techniques that are counter-faction. And what happens then on the factional level is it becomes a game of strategy. And you simply recognize that there are just gobs of interest groups competing, and that what the United States does, if everything is moving in a healthy kind of way, is the United States does whatever the strongest passion or groups of passion move it to. And so the United States is sort of like a passionate animal. And whatever the strongest passion is will determine the direction the critter goes. And if you don't like the direction the critter is going, you try to move it in another direction. It's like a push ball competition, like a great big ball, and you're out there and you're trying to move it from one goal to another. You know, you got all those competing interests pushing against that ball to move it. And what Madison is saying is, you know, unwieldy and cumbersome and difficult as this form of government is, it is the form of government which is most likely to prevent oppression. It is a government which will last the longest, and it is the form of government which will give people a maximum amount of freedom. Now, if you want security, if you want welfare state, you want something else, this isn't the form of government for you. But if liberty is the thing that you prize most, this is the best form of government you can have. Now, that's what Madison's argument is. But it is a kind of argument where certainly you're going to have faction, contention, competition, wheeling and dealing, angle working, and so on. And it's not the best form of government to achieve certain sorts of things, but it is the best form of government for people that whose highest value is personal freedom. But it means that everybody's got to stay on his toes also, and you can't sit around and hope that other factions are going to be benevolent and kind and loving. And you got to go in and scratch for what you want, too. All of which makes for a very active electorate. Mary?
I don't know. I'm really interested to find out about this, but I'm so dumb in this area. And I have been trying to figure out this year, and it's maybe you can tell me, did Madison ever define liberty in terms of government as being identified or closely related to the pursuit of happiness?
No, in the Federalist Papers, they do not talk to, and they mention justice maybe once or twice. They don't talk about liberty at all.
No.
They're very much oriented to strategy, structure. Mm-hmm. That's the whole orientation of the Federalist Papers, mm-hmm. practical politics. Mm-hmm. And so they don't talk in terms of ideals, goals, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the fascinating things about Federalist Papers. You know, they virtually ignore the preamble to the Constitution.
Yeah.
The general opinion is, well, they took it for granted. They assumed everybody agreed on it. I would judge that probably what Madison would mean by freedom on the individual level as maximizing passion satisfaction. In other words, satisfying as many of your interests as possible.
Which would be sort of equating it with what they understood as
pursuit of happiness, yeah. And finding a certain measure. Right. On the national level, he probably would define it in terms of a maximum number of citizens achieving their interests. Well, this is a form of government where the most people can satisfy the most interest, most of their interests. Interest being undefined. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that's the way he would have defined it. Now you go into the ancient classical tradition, you know, both in Plato and Aristotle, freedom consists in rational thinking. Yeah, and the ability to do that. But here it's very pragmatic and down to earth, you know, and if doing your thing is watching TV and eating pizza and drinking beer, you know, that's your liberty.
Or should you stop money?
Right, that's right, sure. Yeah. Okay, well, on Saturday, after we have rejoiced and frivolized and so on, I'll talk a bit about the difference between federalism, democracy, nationalism, and so on, and then also that Federalist Paper on the basis of which Marshall drew the conclusion that the Supreme Court was the final authority in interpreting the Constitution. Okay?